Samuel Johnson was a towering figure in the 18th century. He compiled the Dictionary of the English Language and wrote learned books about Shakespeare and the leading poets. But we know Dr. Johnson today for another reason. Boswell's Life of Johnson, the most famous biography ever written. Steve Paulson talked with two writers about their recent books on Boswell and Johnson. Adam Sisman's study of the biography itself is called Boswell's Presumptuous Task. And Beryl Bainbridge has written the historical novel According to Queenie. She says Dr. Johnson's greatest achievement was getting to know his biographer.
Now, without James Boswell, I doubt if we really would have heard of Johnson. Not many people would have read the things that Johnson wrote. It's purely because this Scottish chap that most people at the time thought was a bit of an idiot went round copying down everything he said.
Well, I read somewhere that all of Dr. Johnson's books were out of print some 40 years after he died. It was Boswell's book that was still around. That's the reason that people remembered Dr. Johnson.
That's the great irony, really, that the biographer who regarded himself in his lifetime as so inferior to his subject in the 19th century eclipsed his subject. Not that he was regarded as wiser. In fact, the more successful his book was, the more foolish he was regarded, but his book was outstandingly successful, and as it were, he captured his subject. He imprisoned him within the walls of his biography. And what Beryl has done brilliantly in her book, and what scholars have been struggling to do ever since, is to try and recapture the Johnson that Boswell didn't know.
Because Boswell only spent a certain bits of his time with Johnson. I mean, most of the time Boswell was either up in Scotland or simply wasn't around when Johnson was visiting the Thrales in their place in Streatham. The Thrales was this wealthy brewer. And in fact, he tried to get invitations, and gradually did, because he wanted to go to the Thrales' house. He wanted to be part of this crowd that was rushing around Johnson all the time.
So what didn't Boswell know about Dr. Johnson?
Well, I mean, for example, he didn't know what Johnson was like when he was alone with a woman. That was a great advantage that Mrs. Thrale did have. She had access to parts of Johnson's heart that Boswell, however fond they were of each other, couldn't reach.
Beryl, tell me about the Thrale family and the role that Mrs. Thrale occupied in Johnson's life.
Well, Thrale was a very wealthy brewer. Mind you, he didn't seem to me to be particularly intellectual, but he was a good, kind man and rather a good husband in a sense, though it wasn't a love match. And he married Hester Thrale, and they had in all 12 children, of whom 8 died. And it was just that a playwright called Arthur Murphy invited Johnson round for supper at the Thrales one night. And he more or less hit it off with Mrs. Thrale immediately. One doesn't know why. Mrs. Thrale wasn't a beautiful woman, but she was very vivacious and she was very clever. She was a very bright woman. And it was almost an immediate friendship. And then, of course, Johnson had a terrible fit of, not exactly madness, but depression and melancholy. They happened to call round at his house to see what was wrong with him. Why hadn't he been round to see them for some time? And they witnessed a terrible scene when he was clutching this clergyman's breeches and shouting out how sinful he was, mostly imaginary sins. So much so that Thrale leapt up the stairs and put a hand over Johnson's mouth. And he said to Mrs. Thrale, take him home, take him back to Streatham and nurse him. And so for 17 years, that's where Johnson stayed.
I think it's worth pointing out that Johnson, too, wasn't a gentleman in 18th century terms. He was, in fact, startlingly uncouth in appearance. He had been very poor and was never rich. He'd been poor enough to be arrested for debt, and he famously sat on a stool that only had 3 legs. One of the fascinations of his relation with Boswell was that Boswell was a man of property, a gentleman, and yet he subordinated himself, he saw himself as the inferior to this intellectual giant. Johnson was able, because of his intellectual force and his moral authority, to speak on equal terms, even with the King of England. And there's a wonderful scene in the life of Johnson where the King comes into a library where Johnson is reading and addresses Johnson, but he defers to Johnson, and the picture that's given is of the King subordinating himself to Johnson rather than vice versa.
Adam, how would you describe Boswell's relationship with Johnson? Because in many ways they seem to be a very unlikely pair.
Well, the cliché is a father-son relationship. There's certainly an element of that, that Boswell had a very problematic relationship with his father, who was a very dour, stern, disapproving judge. And he longed for someone who would take him for what he was and enjoy him for what he was. His father wanted to make him into a successful man of business, and Boswell wasn't cut out for that. Boswell and Johnson both frequently said that they loved each other, and I think they did in a way. They did love each other. I think they did enjoy each other's company, and I think that one of the things that endears us to Boswell is the fact that Johnson liked him so much. As far as their relationship is concerned, well, it was never an equal relationship of equals, or very rarely. Boswell always subordinated himself to Johnson, even though Johnson was definitely from a lower social class, and occasionally Boswell liked to parade that. But he acknowledged Johnson's superiority and very rarely dared to contradict him, except on one subject, which is the subject of the rights and wrongs of the American colonists. There, Boswell felt quite strongly on the side of the Americans. In fact, he secretly celebrated American victories. And he dared to disagree with Johnson, who was very against the rebels, and they had several quite loud quarrels on the subject.
Well, it seems that Boswell also played the fool. He was the neophyte who always played up to the great man. And I guess I'm wondering if that was just an act, the way to curry favor with Dr. Johnson, or whether that was just the nature of their relationship.
I think a bit of both. I mean, I think he definitely did at times put on an act, and he had a strange way of trying to create scenes. He liked to set up, introduce subjects into the conversation to see how Johnson would react, or try and set up Johnson with other people. I mean, most famously, perhaps, with John Wilkes, who was just about as different from Johnson as could possibly be imagined, and a man of whom Johnson violently disapproved. And he brought them together at a party where Johnson couldn't decently leave, and then recorded this scene, which is one of the most delicious scenes in the whole of the life of Johnson, not least because both Wilkes and Johnson end up getting on rather well and teasing Boswell. And Boswell recorded all of this. In fact, he enjoyed being teased, enjoyed being able to depict this whole situation, having brought it about. So there was an element in which he was a kind of, I don't know what you would say, I mean, a sort of Svengali, perhaps, or a kind of... he did manipulate Johnson for his own purposes.
Adam, do you think Boswell actually knew what he was doing? That how amazing what he was doing was?
I think that's a very difficult question, because I think that he sort of half knew and he half didn't. I mean, he definitely liked to, I mean, he said in his diaries he liked to introduce subjects and see how Johnson reacted. And sometimes Johnson got very cross. Sometimes he realised that he was being manipulated. And he said, for example, on one occasion, "You've got but two subjects, yourself and me, and I'm sick of both."
And the most interesting part of that is that Boswell recorded it, even though it makes him yes. look foolish, and it makes him look ridiculous, but he made sure that he put it in his notebooks and then later in the biography.
Absolutely. I mean, for example, there's another scene where they're discussing a mutual friend, Langton, who they feel ought to spend more time on his estate. And Johnson says rather cruelly, "We'll send you to him. If he does not tire of your company, nothing else will send him away." And Boswell's terribly hurt and, in fact, stays away for the next few days to show his hurt. But nevertheless, it's recorded there in the life of Johnson.
And to put this in perspective, when Boswell's biography of Samuel Johnson eventually came out, there had been nothing else ever written like this, to record those kinds of private conversations, to point out the flaws in someone as well as the virtues. I mean, this was a radically new kind of book.
It was entirely radically, and many people disapproved of it. And in fact, Boswell, who had hoped for praise, as we all do when we write books, found that actually, in certain sections of society, he found himself ostracized. And one of his great friends said, reluctantly asked him to dinner, but said, "But no letterpress on this occasion." And people began to shun him because they knew that he was in the habit of taking down their conversation or noting it in his journal afterwards.
His ending, though, it was very sad, that. Don't you think, reading in your biography of it, that it's an awful bit of this man who was going downhill fast, both physically and he had very little money, didn't he?
Well, I'm not sure he'd had very little money in Johnsonian terms, but I mean, I think there is a sense in which writing this life of Johnson was the central duty of his life. And when that was over, there was really nothing left for him to do. And in a rather profound sense, but Boswell was himself very flighty. He was half mad in a way, and many of his relations had ended up in asylums or in straitjackets. And there was a sense in which by writing about the sanest man, the wisest man of his generation, Boswell was making sense of his own life. And that when that was done, there wasn't really anything else for him to do. He just faded away.
Boswell's book, when it finally came out, and it took him, what, 7 years to write after Dr. Johnson died. And so obviously Boswell labored over this, but it was also dismissed, or he was dismissed as a literary stylist because various people said, oh, he just regurgitated what Dr. Johnson told him. There was no sense that Boswell himself was a skilled writer.
Well, I mean, as we all know, the great art is to hide the art. And, I mean, what Boswell appeared to do, and also, I mean, it was partly his own enemy in this. He laid great stress on the verisimilitude of what he was doing. You know, he frequently used the word authentic. He wanted to give the idea that he was recording what Johnson had said almost verbatim. And therefore, people didn't realize for a long time what artistry had gone into his recreation of these scenes. And it was many, many years. And really, the discovery of Boswell's journals, which began to change all of that, people began to see how skillfully he'd taken this raw information that he had at his disposal, and that in itself was remarkable, and then constructed that into a book that created a character that in its own way lives and breathes. You know, it's arguable that Samuel Johnson is more alive to us than any man in history, and that is principally thanks to James Boswell.
Adam Sisman and Beryl Bainbridge talking with Steve Paulson. Sisman's book, Boswell's Presumptuous Task, won the National Book Critics Circle Award. Bainbridge's novel about Dr. Johnson and Mrs. Thrale is called According to Queenie.